Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Maggie Smith has been called a poet for times of trouble. And it's true that her work has a way of exploring difficult feelings and painful moments with empathy and honesty. In her new collection of poems called Goldenrod, we see Maggie's ability to capture wonder and joy in the everyday, at the mysteries of life, nature, and being a parent, and watching her children grow, and also the concern and fear for others for whom the basics of life have been taken from them. I'm happy that Maggie Smith can join us now. Maggie, welcome back to All of It.
Oh, it's so good to be back. Thank you.
We would love it if you would read the title poem from this book, Goldenrod. Would you read that for us?
Absolutely. Goldenrod. I'm no botanist. If you're the color of sulfur and growing at the roadside, you're goldenrod. You don't care what I call you, whatever you were born as. You don't know your own name, but driving near Peoria, the sky pink-orange, the sun bobbing at the horizon, I see everything is what it is exactly in spite of the words I use. Black cows, barns falling in on themselves, you. Dear flowers born with a highway view, forgive me if I've mistaken you, goldenrod. Whatever your name is, you are with your own kind. Look, the meadow is a mirror full of you, your reflection repeating. Whatever you are, I see you, wild yellow, and I would let you name me.
There's so much color in this book. There's one poem where blue is very much the focus. There's another poem with all the different kind of greens that are out there. In this poem, Goldenrod, what was going on with you in color as you were writing these poems?
That's such a cool observation. It's always funny when other people read the book and then I'm like, oh, that is in there. Oh, there are lots of birds. Oh, the sky does pop up in so many of these poems. Because, you know, you write one poem at a time and often you don't see the connections between them until later when you're printing everything out and seeing if you have a book and seeing how they're in conversation. You know, a lot of the observations in nature and observations about color come from my walks and my long drives, which over especially the past year and a half have been sort of, soul feeding.
The book is divided into three sections, and each section seems to have its own, I don't want to say theme, it's more like identity or energy to it. How would you describe parts 1, 2, and 3?
I sort of organize the poems as a whole. So when I'm putting a book together, I'm thinking about, okay, I think I want to begin with this poem. How does it end? What's the tone? What's the natural next move? And then I go through the whole stack and I decide which poem wants to follow poem 1. And then I go through the whole stack and I figure out which poem wants to follow poem 2. And so it's kind of like sequencing an album in a way. Like what transition makes sense? What is the most either natural or impactful between poems? And then I see what I have overall. And then later I go through and decide if I want to leave it one big section or divide it into 2 or divide it into 3 or 4. And so with this one, it's sort of 3 acts, and I see the middle section as being sort of the hardest part of the book. I think there's a lot of difficulty that comes up in the middle of the book, and I wanted those poems to be in conversation, but then I wanted to be able to, in the end, not solve all those problems, because that's not the way the world works, but kind of have a little bit of a lift toward the end of the book.
If someone decides to sit down and read this book in one sitting, which they could do, what would you want them to consider as they are going through it?
You know, I think so much of poetry it can be a little daunting for readers because we think we're kind of on the outside of it, or maybe we're not trained to read poems, or maybe we actually got a C in the one class we took and we feel like it's a little strange for us. And so what I like to do and what I like to suggest people do when reading a book is, first of all, yes, try to read it from the beginning to the end because that's how the poet arranged it. But also, if you don't want to do it that way, that's okay. You can pick it up and flip until you find something that catches your eye and read that poem or two or three and then put it down. And what I think is maybe more useful than trying to sort of figure the poems out or decide, yikes, what they mean, quote unquote mean, it's reading them and noticing how you feel as you're reading it or what it makes you think of, what associations from your own observations or experiences are you bringing into that poem? What do you notice about what the writer's done? And I think that probably readers will see parts of their days, their time with their kids, their dog walks, their road trips, their trips to the beach or to the woods or just kind of milling around their neighborhood. I think they'll see a lot of their own lives in this book, too.
So interesting you should bring that up, because my next question was about how readers reacted to your last book of personal essays. That's when you were on the show last in October. The name of that book is Keep Moving, Notes on Loss, Creativity, and Change. This began as a series of tweets you wrote while you were going through a divorce. The book became a bestseller. From what readers told you and messaged you and DM'd you, what was resonating with them about that book?
Well, I wrote Keep Moving during probably the hardest year of my life personally, when my marriage ended and sort of becoming a single parent and being self-employed and all of the things that came with that. And the book came out during a year when we were all going through one of our most difficult years collectively. I didn't obviously know that the pandemic was going to happen when I wrote the book, but it was released into that landscape. And so what I heard from people all over who were going through their own stuff. And so it actually seems sort of perfectly timed that book came out during a year when we all needed a reminder that we can do it, that we can do the hard things, as Glennon Doyle says, and push forward and sort of keep not a Pollyanna sunny outlook, but a realistic sunny outlook, and knowing that whatever we're going through in the moment is temporary, and there's sort of light on the horizon if we can just sort of keep moving in that direction.
My guest is Maggie Smith. Her new book of poems is called Goldenrod. Modern technology is addressed in how it changes our lives and the way we express ourselves. There's a poem in here that addresses how autocorrect can sometimes make us feel. it's both funny, and then it's a sad turn, and then it's funny again. Would you read Rose Has Hands?
Sure. Rose Has Hands. My phone doesn't observe the high holidays, autocorrecting Shana Tova to Shaman Tobacco, Rosh Hashanah to Rose Has Hands. Apples and honey for a sweet new year, or apples and honestly, or news and years, always more than one. Yesterday, my daughter asked, out of what felt like nowhere, but must be a real place inside her, when people kidnap kids, do they kill them? Why would someone kill a kid? When I texted my husband this, my phone corrected kill to Killarney, kid to kids. We have two. My phone suggests their names, suggests what the duck, suggests news, years, and honestly, what truth can I tell her? I don't ducking understand. I don't understand ducking any of it.
When did you write that poem? What prompted that poem?
It really did come from texting and having and having my phone not understand the high holidays and autocorrect. And it came also from a conversation I had with my daughter in the car when she asked what do kidnappers want? When kids get kidnapped, why? Like, do kidnappers just, maybe they can't have their own kids, and that's why they kidnap them? And then what happens? Does the kid just have a new family? And it was just such an innocent question and such a strange thing. And of course, this also comes out of, you know, there's another poem in the book that's sort of inspired by seeing kids hauling a flag down to half mast after Sandy Hook, and wondering if the kids hauling the flag down to half mast know why they're doing it, know what's happened at this other school. And so a lot of the backdrop of these poems is raising children and not knowing exactly what to tell them, which is of course what my poem Good Bones is about, and trying to learn as they get older how to be more honest with them about the dangers they face in the world, while also not frightening them into not wanting to go out and engage with that world.
Yeah, some of the poems deal with uncertainty and mystery about parenting and the afterlife. What is it about uncertainty that interests you as a poet?
Well, I think that's my biggest inspiration or questions. You know, things I don't understand. I don't really sit down to write a poem because I figured something out and I'm there to share my wisdom with readers. That would be a terribly pedantic and boring poem. Mm-hmm. So when I'm sitting down to write a poem, what I'm bringing to the page is trouble. I'm bringing my own worry, my own questions, my own sort of need for discovery to the page. And that's usually where a poem begins. So if these poems have anything in common, and really probably everything I've ever written has anything in common, it's that they were born from me grappling with things and using the poem as a place to kind of bring that stuff and process it for myself. And so the poem becomes a kind of record of discovery. And if I've done it well, then the reader has a moment of discovery when they're reading it too.
In this poem, Confession, these are the beginning lines. My son's terrible fevers are softening me to God, to the idea. When he sizzles to the touch, speaks a strange new language of not consonants and not vowels, I need one golden iteration I can live with. I think any parent who's had a kid with a really horrible fever, how scary that is and how frightened you get. How has having children affected the way you think about spirituality? That first line, my son's terrible fevers are softening me to God.
Yeah, I mean, it makes me understand the need. It puts me in a place where I feel disadvantaged if I cannot have faith in something bigger than myself, because who else can I call? And that's the feeling in that poem is, I think I finally understand. There's a line later, this must be how it happens, how need alchemizes into belief. The feeling of needing help so badly that you look wherever you can for it. I think having kids has made me more more porous to a lot of things, and sort of more susceptible and more sensitive to a lot of things. And faith is one of them. And so while I wouldn't consider myself a religious person, I would probably call myself a spiritual person, and that I'm someone who is open to the mysteries of life, and that there are things out there bigger than me that I can't possibly understand. And in times when particularly my children are in need, I'm not hesitating to call on some benevolent energy to please come down, because I'm not sure these cold washcloths are going to do the trick.
My guest is poet Maggie Smith. We're talking about her new book of poetry called Goldenrod. Now, earlier this week on Twitter, you wrote, "It just struck me, I don't remember writing this poem. Funny how pain can make amnesiacs of us. But the work, it commemorates even what we might wish in our pain to forget. The work remains. Thank you for sharing this poem from Goldenrod." And the poem you're referencing is poem beginning with a line from Basho. Would you read this poem for us now?
Yes. Poem beginning with a line from Basho. The moon is brighter since the barn burned. And by burned, I mean to the bones, the rafters on the ground, a whale's ribcage. A barn is mostly kindling. No wonder it went up like that, whoosh. Or should I question my perception? As the therapist tells me, look for evidence to support the feeling. 1 minute, beams. The next, smoke. Didn't my husband say hardly to me at all, it was a long time coming? In this still smoldering field, I am looking for evidence. How can something stand for years and then, just like that, where the roof was all this night?
When you write a poem like that, that deals with life's difficult moments, what does it feel like to read it later?
Well, I mean, as you mentioned from Twitter, sometimes it's surprising. I don't, I can remember writing a lot of poems, and they usually start in journals or on legal pads. And oftentimes I can flip through an old journal. I can find a few scrawled lines and see the germ that would later sprout into a poem. And often I can go back and read something and I can remember where I was sitting. You know, goldenrod, I was sitting in the passenger seat of a car, scrawling on a pad of paper in my lap. And I can put myself back into, you know, even the space I was in when I got the idea. And some poems, that is lost to me. And this is one of those poems. And I think it's because this poem hurts. Mm-hmm. And so I don't actually remember composing it. I know it's mine. It was in a Word document in Garamond font 12, which is what I use, among all my other poems. I know I wrote it, but I don't remember exactly when or where. And so there's a feeling of surprise. Talk about discovery. There's a feeling of surprise sometimes when I go back to a poem and I think, oh, yes, I remember. It's a kind of time capsule. I remember, if not writing that poem, I remember the version of me who felt that.
There are poems in this collection, Goldenrod, which really touch on politics and current events. For example, the treatment of migrant families and children and parents being separated. The poem Tender Age made my producer, Catherine, think of Allen Ginsberg's America, especially the stanza, America, you are grand in theory, poor in practice. You were not what I learned in grade school. Now, Ginsberg's poem, for people who know it, is clearly a political poem. Do you consider your poem a political poem?
Tender Age is probably the most overtly political poem I've ever written. I tend to sort of move at things sort of through a side door most of the time in my work. And this one, I think I confronted it a little bit more head on than I'm used to. And it just seemed the way to do it. I couldn't imagine how to subtly show my disgust for what was happening in my country as an American, but also as a mother, and how to explain this to my kids, that this is something that was happening and was being sanctioned. And so, yes, I mean, this is about as political as it gets for a Maggie Smith poem. And it's a long poem. I tend to whittle as I write. And so the poems usually in revision get smaller and shorter and more condensed and concise. And this one I let sprawl over a few pages because it just felt, it felt right to me. And also I think Ginsberg gave me permission to write a longer poem.
I was gonna ask, what did it feel like for you to just take on political issues head on in your poetry?
Honestly, uncomfortable. I think usually for me, I find like the quickest way to kill a poem is to have it be pedantic and have it be something that tells readers what they already know. So a poem about, something bad being bad, that's not really teaching us anything we don't already know. I want for people to have a moment of sort of an aha click, or a moment of discovery, or a moment maybe that forces them to sort of question or reconsider something or look at something from a new perspective. And it's difficult to do that if you're just saying, I'm mad about this and it's wrong. And so I had to find some ways in the poem to do it my way, in a way that didn't feel too preachy, I guess, is the word I'm going for. Because I think, you know, there's no sense in preaching to the choir in a book of poems. But it was also, I will say, it was also really freeing to just say the thing. Sometimes it's hard to just say the thing in a poem or in a conversation or in a work email, let's be honest. Sometimes it's hard to just say the thing. And so that that felt good.
We started the conversation talking about how you assembled the book, and you told us this great idea of one poem leads to the next, leads to the next. So I want to ask you about the last poem in the book, and I'm going to ask you to read it. How did this poem, verse, chorus, bridge, how did that wind up being the last poem?
Well, I'll read it first, maybe,
okay.
and then I can explain why the ending, I chose it as the ending. Verse, chorus, bridge. Until we find the right chord, we can busy ourselves with the lyrics, rhyming not words, but the ideas folded and stacked inside them. Each word unzips its edges and expands to make space in copse for dusk, crepuscular deer. Room enough for a doe crossing plum road, the rest hesitating at the shoulder. Room for the little daylight left. We've spent so much already, thinking there would be more. Each unzipped word, impossibly spacious. Room enough in crepuscular for horizon. Room for the sallow boundary hours, green gold, when light is making a decision. You can see its thinking happening in real time. While the right chord searches the air, we can slant rhyme what we know now with what we thought before. We must be coming to the chorus now. So, there were different orders, to be honest. The order of this book is the order I landed on, but it went through different iterations. And in some ways, this isn't the right order. It's just the order I decided on. If I cut this book up and shuffled it, it might work. Because the poems all do kind of speak to each other. But I personally liked this move last because I kind of liked the way that coming to the chorus now leaves us sort of hanging at the end of the book and expecting something that's not there. You get white space after that. So what is the chorus? Like, what is that sort of metaphor? And I think it will be probably different for each individual reader than it was for me. But for me, in a song, the chorus is like the part you belt out. It's the part you, you know, turn up the radio and roll down your windows for. It's the part you sing the loudest and the part you look forward to. And so for me, it was a hopeful note to go out on this particular idea. And it also fairly rips off a line from a Pavement song. Gold Sounds, coming to the chorus now, is absolutely from a Pavement song. So it's also a little nod to one of my favorite bands.
I think Steve Malcolmus, he'll be happy to hear that.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe he will. I don't know. Maybe I'll get a letter from his lawyer. I'm not sure. But maybe he'll be pleased. I made a little Spotify playlist for the book, and I put Gold Sounds on it so people can hear him sing the words. And it's even better in his voice than it is just on the page.
That's very cool. I'm going to go look up that Spotify playlist. My guest has been Maggie Smith. The name of the book is Goldenrod, a book of poems. Maggie, thanks for joining us on All of It.
Oh, it's always so good to be back. Thanks so much.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.